Well, let's get this meeting called to order, and now that our minute crew is here, and I think we have a quorum, so why don't we do the minutes? Representative Elkins, have you looked at the minutes?
I have, and I am prepared to move the approval of the minutes of the meeting of February 19th, 2019.
Minutes have been moved. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Welcome this nice, bright winter wonderland morning.
Oh, it's wonderful this morning. And it's about 76 degrees in South Florida, where I came from about 6 months ago, so I'm still thinking about it.
You be careful. Kirk Cousins tweeted that out, and there's a big brouhaha in the press that tweeted out that he was in Florida, and yeah, it was nice and warm and sunny, and everyone's mad at him now,
yeah,
so
yeah,
be careful. Right. Anyway, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Poirier, and I'm the Acting Commissioner of Minnesota IT Services and Minnesota State Chief Information Officer. We prepared a slide presentation, an agency overview for you today, but before launching into that, I did want to provide some opening remarks and tell you a little bit about my background and experience. I was raised in Massachusetts in a family of tradespeople and small business owners. After high school, I enlisted in the United States Air Force, where I began my career in the nuclear missile fields in Montana before earning my degree, gaining my commission, and moving into the technology and cybersecurity field in the early 1990s. In my last military position, I commanded the organization that operated the Air Force's IT enterprise, provided cybersecurity defense, and trained the Air Force forces that supported offensive cyberspace operations. During this period, my team also completed a consolidation of core IT services supporting 800,000 customers in the Air Force mission worldwide. After retiring as a colonel from the Air Force, I went into the private sector, where I served as the Chief Information Officer and Chief Security Officer for a national charter school network, where my team transformed local IT operations across 8 states into a national enterprise IT organization. Early last year, I learned about the challenges facing Minute and was excited about helping to lead a state government through the same type of transformation process that I orchestrated in both the military and the private sector. In June of 2018, I took on the role Chief Technology Officer for Minnesota IT Services. The last 7 months in the state's Chief Technology Officer role has helped me to understand the complexities of this organization as I serve as the Acting Commissioner until the Governor makes a permanent appointment. That said, Minute is an agency in constant motion, an agency that is two-thirds of the way down the path to centralizing those commodity type IT services that all large organizations, be them in the private sector, government, or military, are seeking to standardize and optimize. Minute is also unique in that we provide vertical and horizontal integration of technology services for every executive branch organization to create a statewide ecosystem that supports government service delivery to all Minnesotans. This makes it challenging to understand the role that Minute plays to maintain the state's enterprise and associated standards versus the role the agencies play in prioritizing and determining technology needs for their needs. It also makes it challenging to understand how the Minute organization functions in terms of financing and oversight. My commitment to you as policymakers is that we at Minute will operate with full transparency as it relates to progress made on IT consolidation, the state of our IT systems, and our cybersecurity posture. And the gaps that exist in Minute's ability to effectively oversee software development efforts that are dispersed in agencies across the executive branch. I believe it will be critical this legislative session that state leaders unpack the findings and recommendations in the OLA special review of the MinLARS rollout, to identify lessons we can apply to future modernization efforts and resource needs. Now is the time for purposeful reflection, because the state's portfolio of applications, many of which are 10, 15, and 20 years old, will need modernization efforts for decades to come. The IT challenges that we face as a state are not unique to Minnesota or to government for that matter. Software development projects carry with them inherent risk, and it is more common than not that they face significant challenges in terms of time, budget, and scope. These challenges are only aggravated by the level of complexity involved in the underlying business processes or the associated statutory and compliance requirements. That doesn't mean that we have to accept that we will have project failures. While adequate oversight will not eliminate problems with projects, it will identify risk areas throughout the life cycle of the project to proactively respond to challenges before we field systems that fail under load and lose the public's trust. The OLA's review of the MNLARS rollout in 2017 illustrated the gaps in project oversight, standards, and best practices, many of which were addressed with MNLARS since 2017 and serve as a catalyst for driving change statewide moving forward. I look forward to working together to identify solutions, be those on policy or budget changes, that will increase the odds of success on these projects moving forward. What I hope we can avoid, though, are the types of broad generalizations that impugn the capabilities of over 2,300 state IT professionals. These dedicated Minnesotans and public servants often forego larger salaries in the private sector to support aging state IT systems that Minnesotans rely on every day to support their health and safety. And our ability to recruit and retain the best talent in Minnesota to do that work is more challenging when oversimplified narratives are applied to highly complex challenges. Finally, as it relates to IT consolidation, it's important to note that the commoditizing of shared IT services through consolidation is steeped in data supporting the business case in both government and the private sector. However, because IT is very personal to individuals and organizations, IT consolidation efforts are met with varying degrees of concern. Service levels, responsiveness, and perceived loss of control are common themes to that end. These concerns have merit, and how we complete consolidation is as crucial to its success as the end game itself. We've learned many lessons from our efforts thus far, and we are employing those as we continue our efforts in this area. I look forward to working with you during my tenure. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some opening remarks. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I will proceed with the presentation.
Go ahead with the presentation.
Thank you.
So, just a little bit of history so that everybody gets grounded in the same knowledge about our organization. Prior to 2011, we had fragmented IT activities going on across the state enterprise. Recognizing this, there was bipartisan support to pass Statute 16E that allowed us to begin the consolidation from a human resource, a finance, and an operations perspective. These activities are still underway for varying degrees of reasons. That said, we have made a lot of progress on the human resources and finance side, and we're still working our way through the IT operations side. As I mentioned before in my opening remarks, we have 2,300 people, and they're not all sitting in the Centennial Building. They're at 90 locations across the state. I think what's kind of a key point here is we do this for the executive branch. We also do this for the 300 counties that we have. We do this across the state in ways and shapes and means that not a lot of people are aware of. The network services and the cybersecurity support that we provide, it's almost as if it's transparent to those governments statewide in the cities and the counties. So depending upon which count you have, because there's always a different count for the number of agency boards and commissions that we serve, and there's some reasons behind that in the statutes, there are 90-plus agency boards and commissions that we do support. And if you can view what MNIT does, if you can imagine all the capabilities and services that are provided by the state, and imagine almost like, I don't know if you recall the picture of Atlas holding up the world, but that's what MNIT does underneath, that kind of holds together the information sharing and the security of our data, our citizen data and our state data across the board. It's probably the best way that I can explain what it is that we really do. It isn't just the network dial tone that we provide. It isn't just the workstation that we provide to a particular a customer. It's bringing all of that together into an ecosystem that supports the state. I really like this slide and give you a minute or so to just kind of look at those numbers. They are daunting. When you think about some of the requests we've had the past couple of years for security, as an example, 1.4 million security events per year. Obviously, 35,000 customers. Our direct customers really are the state agencies and the employees, because the agencies, we support all of those, and we do our work through those agencies and that support. I've mentioned about our aging applications that we have. There's 2,800 agency applications that we have to secure and maintain. And then, once again, the 87 counties, 300 cities, and 200 public higher education that we're providing some form of network dial tone for or security. And how we operate. I think, you know, MNIT's been around for about 8 years, and I've talked with folks across campus, whether that's in other agencies, whether that's legislators. And it's not, I don't think it's really well understood that MNIT is everywhere. That, once again, we're not in that centennial building. We have staff that are applied across all those major agencies, and there's two different things that we're doing. The first thing is providing the enterprise service capabilities. That's that network dial tone that I keep mentioning. It's the basic stuff like email, workstations, and so forth. Those common shared services that you would see at any agency, or really any business in America, those common things, that's that enterprise IT function, that is performed centrally. Whereas the majority of our work, about two-thirds of the expenditures, are done at the local agencies, and in concert with the local agency needs, and in concert with the priorities that they have for their particular agency. I wanted to bring up this slide right here because when I began to think about the narrative that we had last year and the narrative that could begin this year, I think it's important to understand that when you run into challenges, whenever you put together a system, it's not the technology alone. It's the coming together, the inextricable linkage between people, the business processes, and technology. During the last session, there was a lot of discussion among the challenges that we had with the technology side as it related to MNLARS in particular. But I think as you read the OLA report, it begins to reveal something even broader, that the business processes, there was no transformation that was done on the front end. There was a lack of understanding of what those business processes ought to be. And if you read in even further and you look at the metrics that you see at DVS, did we have the right staffing at DVS to support the ongoing operations as well as all the work that was being done to implement a massive change in how it was that DVS and the deputy registrars were going to do business. Those are the kinds of things that I think will become recurring issues that need to be discussed as time goes on. So I'd offer that as we move forward over the next 2 days, 2 weeks, or two decades in the modernization efforts for our IT enterprise, that we take into consideration all of these things. And the only last element that is right in the middle, and that's culture. We have to have the support of the legislature. We have to have the support of the executive branch in order to make the kinds of changes that we need to moving forward. And I'd offer to you that our governor is wholly behind that. His Blue Ribbon Council for our IT transformation efforts that we're going to be doing moving forward, that he's standing up, is a huge step in the right direction for what it is that we need to do. Last slide I just wanted to mention here are the couple of key priorities. I could probably come up with 10, but really it comes down to two basic things. We need to keep our government data and our citizen data secure, and we need to modernize the state enterprise and really need to start thinking about that, not from a biennium perspective, but start thinking about that over a 10 to 20 year path. Mr. Chairman, that's all that I had prepared for the slides today, and I'm ready to answer any questions that you may have, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Poirier. First question on the list here is Representative Elkins. He's got a couple questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, welcome this morning. So I spent the weekend reading 150 pages worth of mostly Minlar's reports. Yep. So what struck me as a 25-year veteran in IT myself, I've been an enterprise architect and a data architect, is that reading all of this, I did not see a single thing that I have not observed in the private sector over the course of my career. These kinds of problems I see have seen repeatedly over and over again. So I want to first of all reiterate your comment that the problems that we saw in the Minlar's project in particular, and recognize you only came in like 7 months ago, so right. This isn't whatever happened isn't on you or most of the current staff that you have immediately working for you. Is that this is not a government problem. These are common IT problems that in many cases aren't, as you're pointing out, really even IT problems per se. I mean, a big chunk of them would be, business failures. So the failure to re-engineer the processes up front, deciding how are we going to leverage this new system to do our business in a better way. A failure from the business to, step up and provide sponsorship and ownership along the way. As a data architect, the big one I saw was a failure to profile the data up front. In other words, you need to evaluate the quality of the data, the inconsistencies in the data, figure out what the difficulties are going to be as you migrate the data from the old legacy system to the new one. In talking with registrars, for example, they told me that many of the problems that they experienced when the project went live were simple problems of failures in mapping the data from the legacy system to the new system, resulting in misclassifications of vehicles as a specific example. And then the failure of the business also in this case to step up to do the basic testing. So, that being said, these are things that in my experience, the business generally doesn't know that they need to do that unless somebody in IT leadership tells them that they're going to. And then the other thing that was clearly a failure in this project was that the business needs to have the funding to backfill for the people who are going to play these roles, whether it's re-engineering, providing the ownership and sponsorship, providing the testing resources at the back end that are going to need it. And so, things that I would characterize is, IT failures. There are clearly some architectural misses. Like I saw a mention in here that at one point it was suggested that the project should move to a more modular services-oriented architecture. That recommendation was not executed. obvious to me, especially as a data architect, the big issue that created the problem where you could not transfer a specialty plate, which was a really dunderheaded data modeling issue, which once embedded in the basic design took months and months after. Well, actually, you know, it's taken a year and a half because that problem existed at Go Live and wasn't fixed until the release about a week and a half ago. And then the other problem, a lot of these things, well, another thing is that you look at the time constraints, is a big part of it was caused by the fact that some of the biggest failures in this whole project were work that was done by private contractors. So, again, farming the work out to the private sector doesn't always make things better. In some cases, it makes things significantly worse. The whole project got constrained because 2 years were wasted having Hewlett-Packard try and do a first try. After 2 years and, what, $14-plus million, we pulled the plug on that one. And then the testing, which was a big flop at the end, the Capgemini Sogetti unit was responsible for preparing the testing plan. That obviously wasn't a thorough enough testing plan because when we went live, there were still all kinds of bugs in the system. And then, lastly, I think in reading through here, what I'm seeing lots of cases of what I would characterize as legislative failures. I've been doing a lot of research myself, so I don't know the answer to this, but I suspect that, there are 49 other states who are registering vehicles, but I would guess based on the totality of everything else I've read in here that the reason that they decided to build rather than buy something from one of the other 49 states is that there were probably unique things that were, complex and ambiguous in state statutes that rendered all of the other 49 unsuitable, when probably the appropriate thing would have been for somebody up front looking at the requirements to say, well, if the legislature, if you did this and this and this, we could buy a system from another state. 2 weeks ago, we had a report in the Transportation Committee called, Minlar's Transaction Accuracy, and we had an extensive discussion at Transportation about that, and went back and read that report afterwards and realized that the biggest cause of the inaccuracies in Minlar's right now were the existence of two contradictory requirements in the statutes. So on the one hand, the statute says that all vehicles of the same make, model, and year should have the same base value for tax purposes, okay? Except that typically the manufacturers don't supply those base values to the state on a timely basis. And so in many cases, a registrar has to collect their best guess from some other source. And supply that at the time of the registration until the manufacturer supplies the correct authoritative base value. But then there's another requirement in the statute that says once the base value has been set, it can never be increased. So we had cases in the data where an erroneous base value in one case of $2 was set on a vehicle, and according to the statute, it was then impossible to correct it. Okay. So on the one hand, you've got a requirement that everybody should be paying the same base value for make, model, and year. Another requirement says you can't change it once it's been set. The only way that you could meet both of those requirements in a system would be to say to the manufacturers, I'm sorry, but you can't sell your car until you've provided us with the correct base value. And I'm sure that the auto dealers would just love that. But there are smaller examples like that throughout, and so I think it's incumbent on us as a body to make the agencies feel like, okay, if there are things in the statutes that are making it really hard for you to design and build your systems or processes, they should feel free to come back to us and suggest changes which in this case probably could have saved tens of millions of dollars that we could have avoided just by streamlining statutes that would have made the project much easier to execute. The other thing that I see just right throughout here is, you know, the project has been plagued by, you know, turnover on staff, which in recent couple of years is caused in large part or to a very large degree just by the uncertainty of the funding that we face. So when you don't know, if you're a contractor, and most of the people working on this project were contractors, and you don't know that your project is funded beyond, you know, January, you're going to start looking for another job. And when you've got 40% a year turnover, as we experienced on this project, it is an incredible drain on productivity when the management of the project is constantly interviewing and onboarding new people. The ability to maintain continuity in staffing is critical to assess the success of a project, especially one this complicated. And the other one I think clearly needs to be addressed is that, especially at the senior levels, the people who should be providing the leadership on a project like this, our pay levels just aren't competitive. So you cannot expect to have the caliber of people that we need to manage projects like this and retain them without some reform of the pay levels, you know, for the people who report directly to you, for example.
I agree. Thank you for your comments.
Yeah, not questions, but I need to get this out that these are not things that are unique to government IT. I see these in the private sector for, of course, the course of my entire 25-year IT career. And we need to step up to the fact that in many cases, some of these problems are caused by our practices.
And Mr. Poyer, the one thing I out of his comments that I caught is the pay levels, and I know the state never pays what the private sector does, but how do the pay levels that we have for the people that are doing this IT compare with the outside, and how does that affect you as an agency?
There is a big differential in the pay levels. There's no question about it. When I think about some of the senior folks on my staff, when I think about even Joan Redwing, who is running the Mid-Large project, and she's done an amazing job at bringing discipline and rigor to this project since November of 2017. She's instituted several different things, whether that's on the overall project management, the quality assurance, user acceptance testing, the regression testing that we've been doing. We've had seven sound releases since November of 2017. We haven't damaged anything that was previously in the system, and have there were 440 workarounds, 440 defects that she discovered in January of 2018, and we've been able to fix over 75% of those thus far through those releases. But when you take somebody like her, she's a public servant. And I want to go back to the comments that I made during my opening remarks, which is it's really important for us to understand what happened here and how was Minute involved in this process and how much of Minute was involved in this process. I would offer to you that at the time of the launch in July of 2017, there were two public servants that were on the Mid-Large team on Minute's side, and the rest was through the private sector, a very crucial partnership that we need to have with the private sector. But a lot of the dialogue that I heard last year, and why I came here last year, was it was just a sweeping generalization about Minute performance. And I think when you think about there are 350 projects on any day of the week that Minute is performing. Our batting average is really, really high. We had a big miss on Mid-Large, and that can't be forgotten. That can't be excused. But I think perspective is really important. And so when we come back to how it is that we convey how we feel about things, what the narrative is going to be, you have people in Minute, some of which can make 2 to 3 times the amount of money that they are making today. And I'm not making that up. 2 to 3 times, yet they're here. And really, when you think about this, when you make decisions on whether or not you're going to be a public servant, there are there are a couple of things that are in play. You're trying to be part of a bigger thing. That's really important. You're trying to be part of a bigger thing. The culture that you have, the bond that you have in an organization, the morale of the organization, almost superficially, those are the kinds of things that keep people from moving from an organization. My brother once told me, he said, you don't go to another organization. A good boss is worth 25% of your salary. And so we need to create this situation in Minute. And it's a function of what the press does. It's a function of what the narrative is with the legislative branch. It's a function of what happens in the executive branch and how it is that people value Minute for what it is that they do. So I would offer, we missed on this on Minlars. We missed in a big way. We are accountable to that, and we have made management changes. We have made huge changes in transforming how it is that we move forward with Minlars, with the project overall. And I would offer that moving forward is kind of the key piece here. 2,300 people, two state workers that were involved in the Minlars issue back in 2017. And yeah, they're all being painted with the same broad brush. We're working very hard. Our leadership is working very hard in Minute to try and we actually have discussions with the employees. I've had employees come up to me, young employees come up to me and say, why is it that they want to kill Minute? I mean, that's pretty profound, and it makes you, and is that going to make you want to stay? Is that going to help retention? On the recruitment side, when we have this stuff in the press, is that going to help recruitment? Or because we're trying to get high caliber people at a wage that that we can afford, but that certainly they can demand more in other places. So I really appreciate this question and the opportunity, Mr. Chair, to be able to embellish a bit on this.
Well, thank you. Representative Vogel. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your service.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate that. I do have some really serious concerns here. And first of all, you know, I'm sensing some disdain for the private sector from which I come and which I deal with. And, you know, we have to recognize that the private sector are the ones that are paying the tax to support this effort. So if we're going to take them on and say that they're not doing a good job, we also have to look at the other side and say, by the way, though, we're asking you to keep paying, and they have been keeping paying, so get that off my chest. Back in 2011, Minute was on the precipice of starting a 2,300-person enterprise, which now has about $500 million a year budget, I'm guessing. Okay. And I realize that there's not necessarily a total respect for the private sector, but in the private sector, if you were starting a company with a $500 million a year budget and 2,300 people, you would have a business plan. So I would expect in this case that we would have had an enterprise plan. I'm curious if there was an enterprise plan. And what I'm talking about here is process. I'm not talking about Minlars or Minsure or whatever. I'm talking about the state started in 2011 a $500 million enterprise business with 2,300 people. Is there or was there a business plan so that a process was put in place to hopefully have prevented the stuff that's been happening?
Mr. Pellier, and I understand that you weren't here at that time, but you answer what you can.
Right, I will. I will. Number one, I wanted to answer, respond to your the first part of your statement. I came from the private sector. I have no disdain for the private sector. And I will also tell you that if you look around Minute and you see how much private sector work is going on, how much that we outsource already today, it's amazing. And that partnership is absolutely crucial. And throughout my career, my success as an individual, the successes of my organization hinged upon having a very solid relationship with industry. You just can't do it without it. So I hope that nothing in my statements or nothing in any of the other dialogue here would say that we would have disdain for the private sector. I saw a comment in the OLA report that I thought was ridiculous, that actually got to the point that you were making, Representative. And I can't remember exactly what the comment was. But I will tell you, I'm glad this was a former senior leader of Minute that made, you know, a nasty comment, and that was part of the OLA report. And I'm glad that person is a former member of Minute, because we just don't have any room for that. As to the second piece of it, Mr. Chair, I was not here during 2011, but I will tell you that we do have a master plan and in fact, we just updated that this past, I think it was in January that we just finished the update. It's a broader plan that we have for that. It didn't start with 2,300 people. And quite frankly, when you start to look at the way that Minute actually operates, because we are federated as much as we are, despite the fact that we have 2,300 people, it's a loose confederation of that. You have folks who work at, say, DHS that feel very much a part of DHS, despite the fact that they're on our payroll, they feel very much a part of it. And I wouldn't want it any other way, because the more embedded that you are with your organization that you're supporting, the better off and the better support that you're going to be able to provide. And so we have that capability across the agency from that perspective. In all of the reading that I've done, Representative, it didn't start off with 2,300 people. It grew to be that over time. It started, the consolidation efforts started with our network services. That was the biggest piece that we were getting at. And we've kind of moved our way up the stack, if you will, brought in workstation management. We have email that we're providing across the enterprise. And we've had a huge focus on getting the commodities in one place, those enterprise services. That's been the focus, I want to say, the past 4 to 5 years. There has not been enough focus on the project management and being able to provide statewide best practices and standards so that you would have standard repeatable processes in the performance and during as you're creating a project and as you're executing through that. So we have a lot of work moving forward to do that. We have a lot of overarching policy that we have to put in place for that moving forward, but that's already being drafted as we speak. The OLA report was a significant step forward. Can't say enough about it, because it actually gives us a nice written pathway through its recommendations for where we need to focus to best utilize taxpayer money and best support the needs of the executive branch.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recognize that you were not here in 2011. I guess what I was looking back and saying, was there a business-enterprise plan put together back then? And I can appreciate that there's been a lot of time since and documentation might not be there. One of the comments, though, is that it did not start as big as it is. But now it is as big as it is, which keeps asking the legislature for more money. So then the question would become, how big is it going to get? What is it going to look like in 5 years?
So if I were to forecast looking 5 years forward, I would expect, and this is based upon, if we had no more volume 5 years from now than we do today, we wouldn't be any bigger. If we had a little bit more volume than we have today, I don't think it would be any bigger. And the reason I'm going to bring this up is because when you finish consolidation, we're about two-thirds of the way through that from an enterprise perspective for all the shared services, you actually begin to leverage the economies of scale. You can save money through the procurement process, and even when there's more consumption of the services, you can hold down the cost growth that's associated with it, not only from the hardware and software perspective, but also from the FTE perspective. We aren't fully consolidated yet. We have one last wave, we call them waves, but we have one last wave of consolidation that's set to begin here in July, and that will take us probably 6 months or so to get that fully vetted through. And then, at the same time, one of the things we didn't do that we started last August was an IT business process transformation effort. There's about 12 different business processes that we perform at the enterprise level to provide these services. And the way that we grew up as a state with all these IT organizations, everybody had a little bit different way of doing that. And so since August, we've been putting together communities of interest, but basically these big teams that take a look at how everybody's doing it, and we figure out the best practice against an ITIL framework, which is a best practice a standard is used worldwide. So we finished two of those so far. I just signed off on our request fulfillment IT business process and our change management IT business process. And we have the others that are going to follow suit with that. So those things, and that needs, those are living, breathing documents. Those will continue to change over time as practices get better and as technology may alter the course. But we have at least laid in place the groundwork for that moving forward. So 5 years from now, if we don't have this huge influx of volume, I wouldn't expect that we would have any more FTE, at least in the enterprise perspective. We have huge projects that come in place. Let's say we're going to modernize the state IT enterprise. I'm hoping we're going to modernize the state IT enterprise. But when we do that, we have to build, you know, these new systems and capabilities. We have to make sure that those project management teams are adequately resourced to do that. And we take into consideration some of the other comments that were made here earlier of, don't pull people off the operations line and leave the customer waiting while we're trying to do the proper investment in modernizing new systems. You have to be able to resource these things properly, well ahead of time, and a lot of discussion and planning up front and what those costs ought to be and how it is that we ought to employ that. I hope that answers your question, Representative.
Representative Volvo.
Thank you, and I know there's a lot to do. I'll just leave the parting thought that when I hear things like oversimplified narratives, it gets back to what I've been hearing the last couple of years is, give us a chance, we'll put this together. From the taxpayer standpoint, I just want to put it out there that the question, does Minute have to prove its culture before the taxpayer should be expected to put more money into this thing? Because we've been hearing this, and some of the comments here today kind of reinforce that again, and that's why I brought up that little quote. So I think as we go forward, and I didn't bring up anything on Minlars because that's a symptom of something that's going on. I'm going back to the process itself, and I think we have something to prove to the taxpayers, and we can't be going back and saying we're not paying people enough, we don't have this, we don't have that. In business, you don't get those chances. If you're going broke, you have to stay alive, and I think we have to treat this the same way and work in a partnership, but by the same token, we can't get into this constant, we don't have this, we don't have that, because we are there, and it's time that we get this fixed, and I think we have to prove the culture to the taxpayer. The taxpayer shouldn't be blamed for not putting enough into this thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to return to the comments about staff. You mentioned that folks can make 2 to 3 times more in the private sector than they can make working for Minute. And so it seems like the reason why they are working for Minute is because they believe in public service, because they understand the value of the work that they're delivering to the state and to Minnesotans. And that's one of the reasons that's going to pull them in the job, but the things that we're going to need to keep them there, obviously we're going to need to be competitive with salary, but we're also going to need to have a workplace where they feel supported by the state, by the public, where they have high morale. And I do think that there has been an oversimplified narrative in terms of talking about the entire agency in one broad brush and looping in employees who had nothing to do with particular projects in that brush. I'm curious what morale is like at the agency right now, and you talked about culture and the importance of making sure that folks are being supported. How can we make sure that we're getting Minute to a place where there is a culture that folks feel like they're supported and they feel like they're empowered to succeed?
Right.
Mr. Poirier.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. It's As we led into this legislative session, I've had discussions with the senior staff that they've had the same discussions with their team. I've had, we have a new employee orientation. We have new employees that are coming in all the time. So, on a monthly basis, we have new employee orientation. I generally start off the new employee orientation with, you might hear some things during the legislative session. You might read some things in the press during the legislative session. They may not necessarily be positive, but I would offer to you that this is what the political process is all about. I ask you all to not take it personal. That's generally how I start off the new employee orientation. That's the common discussion that I have with the senior staff. I'd say, we're going to have a few hearings this week. Just be prepared. Not sure what the narrative might be. I will tell you, so far, this is, I think, my third session, and there hasn't been anything that's been particularly a sweeping generalization. I think having the OLA reports has been helpful in that we can now begin to take a look at those, be informed by those, and move forward with those. If I were to give a judgment of the morale right now, it's stable. It's not heading down. It's not heading up. It's that process that we're in right now. I think folks will. There's obviously they see the bills that are coming out. And we saw a minute bill on the other side, the kill minute bill. That piece came out again. And so that always makes people wonder. But it's the job of myself and more importantly, the awesome senior team that I have to be able to navigate through that, keep people focused. We have a lot of work that we're doing on a daily basis, and we can't have folks distracted, reading the next article. In the press, they may have something negative to say about that. So I really do appreciate that question. We're good.
And it reminds me of back when one of my sons was still in grade school, he was getting a magazine, and they had a contest in it, just top office humor. People put up on their walls the jokes that they put up, and the one that came out of number one was, "The beatings will continue until morale improves." I think that's what we've been doing a lot of them. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'd just like to, when you talk to Minute employees next, if you could convey our thanks for the work that they're doing every day on a very complicated and tough job to keep us safe from cyber attacks and to make sure that our enterprise is working smoothly. So please convey that from us.
I certainly will, Representative. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Acting Commissioner. Thank you for the hard work that you do. But we're not here to, gloss over the issues. So I have taken a look at the Minlar's report, and I just want to have a conversation with you about some pretty strident indictments of the work that Minute has done. I would suggest to you that you find a different analogy than Atlas holding the world on its shoulders, because I think if we take a look at past experience with the large projects that you've undertaken, I feel like there's something missing, and I, you know, Atlas might be crumbling a little bit if we use that analogy too long. You know, if you take a look at the report, particularly in Chapter 2, there are a number of comments made in here, and I'll just ask for you to respond to the where it talks about Minute officials told us that executive-level involvement is critical to the success of any IT project. That, I guess that goes without saying, but the implication here in the OLA report is that it was lacking. It goes on to suggest Minute's weak oversight and guidance contributed to DPS's failure to ensure that MnLARS was ready for release. It goes on in subsequent chapters talking about the lack of regression testing prior to release as a whole, as opposed to some commentary about releasing it in smaller chunks, if you will, modules that were more digestible and administratively feasible by DPS. I do want to talk about page 23 because I think that goes to the core of what I find still very, very troubling. You talk about that the OLA report has provided you with a path to progress. My comment is, why does it take the OLA report for you to find a path to progress? My sense is, and my experience has suggested that, as Representative Vogel also iterated, you shouldn't have to have an audit in order to find progress going forward. It should be organic from within. And I'll look forward to your response to that. But I just wanted to read this section from page 23. Various Minute leaders, past and present, told us that Minute's oversight of agency software application projects has not been as rigorous or well-developed as necessary. For example, Minute's first commissioner, who left the agency in 2015, told us that by the time she left, Minute's role in agency-based software development was perhaps a quarter of the way toward where it needed to be. Minute's second commissioner, who left the agency in 2018, told us software development wasn't where I wanted it to be when I left, flat out. When asked if Minute had adequate policies for software development, he said no. Another former Minute executive agreed that standards for software development were inadequate, describing Minute's software development practices as the Wild West. Current and recent Minute officials told us that Minute did not develop or has yet to develop adequate policies or standards to govern the architecture of software developed by agencies. You made a comment about that you're learning from your mistakes. That sounds eerily and surreal, very surreal, to comments that we heard in committee when the OLA report came out after the debacle that was Mincher. It doesn't sound like we've learned anything from these two very, very high-profile, very large projects that have gone south to the detriment of our taxpayers and to the detriment of the people who use those systems. And so I'm looking for a response from you in terms of, you talk about any number of other programs that have been a success, but perception is reality. And we've got two very, very large high-profile failures that from two OLA reports, you could have stamped MnLARS on the first one and Mincher on the second one, and there would have been no distinction between what failures were not corrected. So I'm looking for a response to that, and then I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Poirier.
No, thanks for the comments, and I read the report as well, you know, and those comments, they're an indictment on what happened prior to July of 17. Mm-hmm. Moving forward, and some of the comments that you had regarding making it more modular, the regression testing and so forth, when we look at what happened in November of 2017, we took our enterprise architect, the state enterprise architect, and we placed her in a leadership position at MnLARS. And during the course from November 2017 until February 10th of 2019, we have had seven successful releases because we've actually put the kind of discipline and rigor in the project management that is expected, that should be the expectation across the board. Seven releases, no breaks that we've had along the way with that. Significant regression testing for each one of those releases, 4 to 6 weeks of regression testing that's happened. So there's been a major transformation in how it is that we do business. And we've actually got 14 months and seven releases of track record to suggest that we've more than turned the corner as it relates to Minlars. But more importantly, we've more than turned the corner in terms of how it is that we need to do this statewide. I have had weekly meetings with my executive steering team as part of our governance structure. And the policies and procedures that we're going to put in place statewide for what should be the best practices for software development, what should be the best practices for project management, those efforts are underway. I can't speak for where we were in 2015. I can't speak for where we were in 2017 with the standards, the best practices, and so forth. This report speaks to where we were. The commentary from the previous leadership speaks to where we were. But I do know that during 2018 and moving forward, a lot of work was done to bring that structure in place. And it's reflected in the progress that we've made with the Minlars program since November of 2017. Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, on page 61, and then the first page of the discussion on Chapter 4, again, I turn back to a comment that Representative Vogel said. You know, I've heard comments made by folks as well as from you this morning that, you know, we just can't seem to find the people to stay because we can't pay them enough. I tire of that for the same reasons as Representative Vogel has displayed to you, is that if this were a private sector experience, I don't think that it's a fair comparison, because what we're talking about here is not about what we're paying people. What we're talking about here is a process that wasn't followed with MinSure, it wasn't followed with Minlars. And I'm trying to understand where the executive leadership for Minit is putting in place the process that will ensure large profile projects are going to be completed satisfactorily to the scope and parameters that are laid out at the initial conception of what needs to be reformed. If you take a look at page 60, it talks about in the discussion of best practices. It talks about a former Minit official suggested to us that Minit should provide greater leadership and direction regarding this aspect of application development. He said this suggests that Minit may wish to consider a broader strategy, not one that is agency-specific, for ensuring the implementation of best practices on future ITs. And it goes right into the next page where it says that to date, Minit does not have effective standards, policies, and procedures for overseeing state agency software projects, and Minit leaders gave significant discretion to smaller numbers of managers. Success starts at the top. And I understand you don't have a new commissioner. Maybe that's a symptomatic of what's going on underneath. And that's not an indictment of the people that are courageously working on these projects. But there has to be a revolution of thinking around your agency, and how, if you are in charge of and responsible for software, heaven help us when we start talking about cybersecurity, which I know Representative Nash and I share a great passion for, and I think it's on the forefront, or should be, of this administration, because if we think we can't solve the riddle of software applications, can you imagine the problem that we're going to face with regard to cybersecurity? I'll look for your response.
Mr. Poirier.
I think As you look at the governor's budget, which was released yesterday, there are a couple of change items that we have in there to begin to address this. Number one of our change items is the project management oversight. We have, I mentioned before, we have 350 different projects going on at any one time. And when you look at how the oversight is done today, we have statutory requirements. We're supposed to report to the legislature on a regular basis the status of those projects. Well, so for 350 projects, I've got three FTE that can provide that kind of support. Three people to make sure that we have, A, the right status, B, that we have the right kinds of audits that are going on, whether that's on a random basis of looking at it at a particular project that's having a, that we believe might be having a problem, or one where it's turned amber or it's turned red, but being able to deep dive down in there and get a better understanding of what's going on and proactively fix those rather than waiting for the OLA to do an audit themselves. I'm not suggesting that this project management oversight function is a replacement for OLA, but what I am suggesting is a lot of the things that the OLA did with these last couple of reports is something that we should have the ability to do at the enterprise level. It's one of the statutory requirements the state chief information officer has, and we're not resourced for that. So the change item is going to address that. On the cybersecurity side, I'm more than well aware of where we sit with our cybersecurity posture here in the state of Minnesota. I ran the cyber defense operations for the entire Air Force. So I'm well in tune with what looks good and what doesn't look good. And we don't look good. And we also have a change item in this budget, which is the fourth straight year that we've had a change item in the budget for increased cybersecurity spending. It's going to tackle not only our data center reduction, but it's also going to tackle the tools and capabilities that we need so that we can proactively respond to adversaries, whether they're nation-state actors or whether they're criminals, to avoid data loss, be that citizen data or be that government data. So moving forward, I think it's important for us to understand there's certain things that were identified in the OLA report and actions that we are taking through the budget process to make sure that we can close the gaps.
Representative Albright. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to respond to one of Representative Vogel's comments first. I want to make it clear that I'm not saying that the private sector is worse. I'm just saying the challenges are not substantively different between what we see in state government and what we see in the private sector. And both sectors face the same kinds of challenges. So I come here, the last 7 years of my career were spent at Optum Technology, part of United Health Group, which probably Optum Technology is probably the largest private sector IT operation in the state. Okay. At Optum Technology, they do salary surveys every year to make sure that their salary structures are competitive because they understand that in order to succeed, they need to be able to attract the best employees. The state needs to be doing the same thing. The kinds of things that that Mr. Coyer is implementing here will require investment. When I was at Optum Technology, the company invested in open group architecture training. They invested in agile development methodology training. These things cost money, but if you're being a good fiduciary, whether your fiduciary, the people that you're responsible to, or the shareholders or the taxpayers, you make these kinds of investments in order to ensure that your IT organization is performing at a high level. I don't disagree with anything. I think that the Office of the Legislative Auditor did a really good service to us for identifying the things that need to be done, And Mr. Poirier is doing his best to see that those things get done, but we have to be willing to provide the resources to enable him to put these best practices into place, that the related training into place, and to make sure that the staffing is there in order and on both the business side when we do these projects and on the IT side in these projects to make sure that we can execute as well as a private sector firm would expect its operations to perform as well. That's all I'm saying.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, we are fortunate now that we have a lot of information that we haven't had for a long time. I've spent a lot of the last couple of years trying to ask friends and acquaintances that I know have the expertise about questions to be asked, etc. I'm going to make a few statements and then just ask you to maybe respond. First of all, the most important thing to me is ensuring data privacy and security. I mean, when we're asking our citizens for personal information, we are responsible for that and protecting that. So that is, to me, my number one job, to make sure we have that. Trying to, over the last few years, trying to determine accountability, it's kind of like a moving target. And you had referenced something about killing minute earlier, so let me ask you a question. I do understand the reason for minute, and to me it's that we have one place where we're going to have all of our system, all of our agencies are able to interact. And that part I get, but the what I guess I'm concerned about is when you're trying to determine accountability, is having minute there a more efficient way than letting each agency be responsible for its for the work that it does? As I said, I've come to my conclusion right already, I think, but I would be interested in your comments on that.
Mr. Poirier.
Mr. Chair. So some of the dialogue that we've heard today suggests that we are better off if Minute is exercising its full statutory requirements and capabilities across the state in terms of providing best practices, project management standards, software development standards, and so forth. So some of the questions that I've answered previously during this session really speak strongly to that. I think that the investments that we are requesting as we move forward will go a long way to shoring up that capability. If we were to leave that to the individual agencies that undergo a major project modernization, it could be every 3 years, it could be every 5 years, in some cases, like in the case of MNLARS, it's every 20 years. There's a lot of institutional knowledge that gets lost when you don't have somebody that does that on a daily basis. There's just things that you forget because you haven't done those things. That's where Minute can really bring its strength in numbers. And as we continue to mature our software development practices statewide, our project management capabilities statewide, we're going to put a laser focus on that. We've spent a lot of time working the commodity a piece of this in the early years of Minute so that we could get ourselves closer. That's the foundation you need in order to build out a real state enterprise, a real ecosystem for those capabilities. So our ability to put a really hard focus on this is only going to benefit not only the existing 350 projects, but what it is that we're trying to do over the next 10 to 20 years with an overall state enterprise IT modernization. Mr. Chair, Representative, I hope I answered your question.
Representative Mason.
Thank you.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner. So I'm not an IT expert. I simply take technology for granted most of the time and really only notice it when something isn't working as quickly as I want it to. But when I take a step back, I start noticing in those times, sometimes if I'm reflecting a little bit, on all of the technology I'm relying on, all the systems I'm relying on to go about my day-to-day life. And I'm imagining that that's also true for the systems that state government relies on, as well that we rely on as people of Minnesota. And so I've been interested, as you've mentioned a few times now, there have been 7 successful releases since 2017. I'm curious if there are other success stories of Minute as this consolidation has been unfolding, some wins for Minute that maybe we might not be aware of in this conversation, or that we might be taking for granted, that are part of this, that should be a part of this conversation too, or part of this story.
Mr. Poirier.
Mr. Chair, there's several kind of wins. The very fact that you wake up in the morning, leap out of bed, pump your fist in the air, and connect your computer, and everything comes up the way that it should. I've never had a customer call me in the morning and say, I just want to let you know the network is blazing fast. I was able to log on without problem, and all the applications seem to be performing admirably. Thank you very much. I've never had that happen, nor should I expect that. And I really enjoyed the comment that you made on the front end. There's just sort of this expectation that it's always going to be there, and there's a lot of dialogue when it's not. When you just think about, from an enterprise perspective, what we've been able to do in the consolidation effort that we've done, we've avoided millions of dollars in cost through the enterprise consolidation that we've done so far. This isn't the sexy part of the information technology piece. It doesn't have the cool factor, because it's all the plumbing and infrastructure that's underneath that keeps everything going. But when I think about what's happened the past 3 years, and specifically, I look back to, I wasn't here when this initially started, but I got all the stories about it. There was a decision that was made that we're going to consolidate, and we were consolidating the enterprise operations of all these different agencies. So they went through a drill where they said, okay, well, you do the service desk here in this agency, and you do workstation stuff here in this agency. You're now consolidated. And that was it. And when you think about everything else that had happened for that, what does it take to actually run an enterprise? You actually have to have governance in place. You have to have different business processes in place, so that if a change is being made in one part of the enterprise, everybody else knows what's going on and it can operate effectively. Once again, there's no cool factor that's associated with it. But we had people who were working on the service desk one day in an agency, or putting in a workstation in another agency, that all of a sudden were put into these enterprise functions, not just doing the service desk tomorrow, or not just putting a workstation in tomorrow, but doing these enterprise functions where they're running business processes. That all that had to be built, and that was built on the good ideas and the hard work of the folks of a Minute. And that's, we're 2/3 of the way through that. We're going to go through our last wave of this, and we're going to continue to do the IT business process transformation to get ourselves to the standards that we're looking for, the best practices that we're looking for moving forward. We're well on our way in that journey. And so if there's one thing that I would want to talk about that I'm particularly proud of, it was the ability for these people to do it, despite the fact that they did not necessarily have the training. You don't stand up enterprises every day. I mean, this is a one-shot deal, and once it's stood up, you just make it better over time. But these were the people who were the initial folks who just all got together and made that happen, not knowing, completely how that was going to come out on the back end. So there was a lot of thinking, a lot of studying, and a lot of planning that was involved with it, And if there's one thing that we should be proud of, it was our ability to do that without investment that came from the budget process. When I did this in the Air Force, we consolidated 800,000 customers. We had front-end investment. We built data centers specifically for this purpose. We had teams that would go from base to base to base and do the consolidation effort that were separate and distinct from the daily operations. We had that. When I did this in the private sector, I had the full buy-in from all the C-level executives to do this. And we were able to do it quickly because we went ugly early on it and just got the consolidation done and began to stand up all those best practices that we needed to do. When we did this here in the state, this was done all behind the curtain because there wasn't any funding for this. We did this all in the background, took people off the operations floor. It impacted the service delivery that we were going to provide to our customers. So some of the challenges that we faced over the past couple of years and some of the commentary that you may see in an upcoming report on it is directly related to the fact that the same people that were answering the phone in the service desk or that were putting the workstation in place for the same people that were trying to pull all of this together and build out an IT enterprise. Sorry for the long reply on it, but I'm very proud of what the team was able to do based upon what was put in front of them.
And members, we're getting close to the end of our time here. I've still got a list of questioners here. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. That's helpful. And it just leads to another question for me. So I'm stepping into a new role, and I'm someone who's comes from the nonprofit world and have stepped into leadership in a few different nonprofits. And as I do that, I'm always thinking about what's happened that needs to be corrected, but also where the strengths are and how we can build on those strengths going forward. And so I'm most interested now to think about, well, how do we move forward in a successful way? How do we move forward in healthy ways? And so I'm curious about just your high-level thoughts there as you look within the agency and as you are in conversation with the legislature, what things do we need to be paying attention to make sure that we are going forward in a healthy way?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question on that. Moving forward, we have a couple of change items that we have moving forward that we believe are really important. Number one is project management oversight. That's going to get at ensuring that we have discipline and rigor across the state in our project management and our software development practices. The second one, and it's, as I mentioned before, this is our fourth year bringing it to the table, is as we need an investment in the cybersecurity arena. As I've looked at where we sit as a state from a cybersecurity perspective, our risk is high. I'm just calling it for what it is. And I see it on a daily basis. You'll read about it in the paper every couple of months when we've had a breach where we've had to notify citizens or other customers of an issue, and it's because we don't have the basic block and tackling in place for us to be successful in that arena. And they aren't, it isn't as if cybersecurity from this perspective, it isn't as if it's just status quo. They keep getting better. They have their own organizations. They have HR teams that hire hackers. There's a lot of money made in being a cyber criminal, and we're part of that piece of the action that they're trying to get at. So those would be the couple things moving forward with that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Poirier. I wanted to first say thanks for stopping by my office right after the beginning of session. And I think I told you there that I don't envy your job. And in fact, I turned down your job when asked by Governor Walz. And it's going to be a challenge, members. And there's a lot of questions that I have. And, Mr. Chair, are we going to have a minute back? Because could go on for a while.
And Representative Nash, we're going to have a minute back when they talk about their budget change items, and we'll have all the other agencies back. So
perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you and I had some very frank conversations, and I appreciated the blunt honesty because rumor has it I might be a little blunt myself. we've had a lot of failure, abject failure, and I could tell in our conversation that that really irked you, and some of my questions were, how do we fix that? So how do we take the OLA report, and rather than just use it as a bludgeon, which is always a good time at, you know, for the cameras like we have over here and, right. and for folks back in the district, but how do we actually take that and map it to change? How do you learn from your mistakes? And for those of us who are in the IT industry and have been for years now, this is not something that you write home about. This is not a proud and shining moment. This is not something that you write in your diary. Dear diary, had a great day at work. We've not had that. So I will recount the conversation. You are willing to roll up your sleeves and come and meet with us and work with us and be accountable to us and be honest with us, which not to besmirch some of the previous folks in your chair, I haven't always felt that I've been given honest answers. We're going to need that. And we're going to need that because we're being asked to write big checks, right? Every one of you is going to have to go back to your district and say, I voted for this, and this I'm comfortable with this. So some of my questions, and I know we are running low on time, but one of my first questions along that line is, last year and the 2 years prior to that, I tried to properly fund cybersecurity by taking a portion of all IT spend, which is kind of a metric that is used in the private sector, and dedicate that towards cybersecurity. That bill was shot down six ways to Sunday. Everybody seemed to hate it, but now we're talking about how much we love the idea of funding cybersecurity. Have you been working with Commissioner Franz, who builds the chargeback tables? Have you been working with him to address that cybersecurity funding shortfall? Because when we tried to appropriate it one time, that was shot down. When we tried to appropriate it programmatically, that was shot down. So I'm just wondering, what are you doing to get that fixed?
Mr. Poirier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, thanks for the comments. First off, I will be candid, I will be honest, and I will be blunt in these conversations, because I think it's important that we don't dance around issues. So I appreciate your comments with regard to that. As far as our funding goes, the real challenge that we have, and this is the political process, I don't own it, I just play a role in providing the commentary to help support certain initiatives. I think, and Representative, correct me to 100%, but I think the challenge that we had with the strategy that you proposed was it was going to force the executive branch to make decisions of what not to fund in order to fund the cybersecurity. And I think that when you get started in doing something initially, you actually have to do an investment. And to be blunt, we wouldn't want to, you know, rob one program in order to pay for another one. I know that this is a big process, and the legislature has to manage risk across the board. But I would offer that it's probably time in where we are in our maturity model as a state enterprise that we need to make an investment in the cybersecurity arena, but not at the expense of another program that's going on. More broadly, the bigger challenge that we have, I showed you that two-thirds of our spend was on project management, a third was on enterprise service operations. But I only get, I think, 1 to 2% of direct funding each year for the programs that we have. Everything else is done on a chargeback. And so when you think about how the funding strategy was done before, there's over 90 different agencies and other organizations, commissions and councils, that all have to make really tough decisions on whether or not they're going to support adding more money to cybersecurity, or whether or not something that is central to their mission will get done or not done. And I'm not saying that in a general fashion. I'm saying that very specifically because there's significant pain that can be felt by the smaller organizations that we support when they're forced to make those kinds of decisions. So I would offer to you
that this investment needs to be independent of the other pieces in the budget that you all have the tough job of working your way through to fund.
And we've heard lots of complaints over the years from different agencies for the what they're charged for these services. But Representative Nash.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'll just cut to the chase on one of my other questions, since this will probably eclipse the amount of time that we've got. I appreciate the bluntness that you've promised to have, and we had a frank conversation, and I told you then that that with me, at least, as I said to your predecessor, that the clock is set to zero until it's time to roll up our sleeves and duke it out. But here's my question. Recently, we were asked for, I think, almost $17 million to fix Menlars. To date, we have yet to have any real detail. Will you provide us that detail before we are asked to actually vote on that appropriation? Because here's the thing, and to Representative Elkins' comment, the difference between IT done here at the state and the difference between IT and a private enterprise is this is taxpayer dollars. And we are accountable to the taxpayers to ask the right questions, to ask the tough questions, to get it right. If a company takes a loss, the taxpayer doesn't suffer. But here at the state of Minnesota, if we screw up, if we have problems like Menlars again, that's on the shoulders of the taxpayer. So before we are asked to appropriate that big bag of cash to, quote unquote, fix it, can we get the details, please?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We have been, we already began briefing the Menlars Steering Committee on this. There's a separate committee where a lot of those details are. Representative Nash, I can provide you those details directly or through my staff afterwards, if so be. But we're going to be very transparent. I will tell you, there's a request that's in for the emergency funding that we need for FY19 for Menlars. And it's really important that we get that money so that we can sustain the operation, so we don't have our private sector fleeing from us because they don't see the capital coming in. And there's some very specific, there are two more releases with this money that we can do in FY19, one in the April time frame, one in the June time frame, and there are several releases that will come after that during the FY20 time frame as well. We prioritized all of the deputy registrar in the DVS needs up front, so that we're meeting the needs of the customer up front. And so we've got a hard focus on it with that. So any level of detail that you need, my staff will be available for that.
And Mr. Poirier, I know that's a different committee that funds the Menlars portion of that, but if you can give us that information to the committee, we can share it with everybody.
Because, absolutely.
As you said, sometimes so we know what that is, and it's helpful in our funding decisions. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is, it's longer than the minute we have left, but it comes down to a bill that I've currently got running through the system, and actually Representative Elkins is on the bill with me. It's House File 524. It's essentially, for those in the business, it's buy versus build. And you've inherited a fantastic slate of things that are being built. I think the problem that we have seen when the state of Minnesota decides to build software on its own, when there are commercially available alternatives out there, is that we have failed miserably. And I'm just asking your opinion on a buy versus build mentality, because I've asked you this question already, but I think that it would be great to share with my colleagues. What is your perspective on the buy versus build for software solutions?
And members, we'll go a little bit longer because we got rules that's been coming in this afternoon, this morning. So if you can answer that, and I know, like you've said already, that most of what you're doing is being done in the private sector, so I think we're doing a little bit of that, but if you can explain your philosophy on that.
Sure. Having come from the private sector and even in previously in government before, buy versus build always comes in right up front. It's a business case. It's what is the best thing to do. If there's a capability that's available commercially off the shelf that we can just buy and plug in, why would we go through a development effort just to say that we did it ourselves? In some of the cases that we have, you could buy a basic product, but there might be a whole lot of work that needs to be done to modify that product in order to meet say, statutory requirements or the specific business requirements that are associated with that. And so you just run the numbers and you run through the trade-offs that it takes to do that. You also have to take consider the risk that's associated with doing that as well. You also have to consider who owns the code when you do something like that, because you don't want to get caught, especially in some of these projects that are big and that cost a lot of money. What you don't want to do is be so embedded with that particular product or so embedded with that particular contractor that you can't get yourself out of that if you need to. A lot of the work that we're doing as we move to the cloud is centered around our ability to be able to move between different cloud providers without getting attached to one in particular. They're all good providers, but if I can move between four different ones on a whim, I can also then negotiate a better deal for the state in that process. So it's a business case, Representative Nash.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I have two quick comments. So to Mr. Albright's point, the devil is always in the details. In the Minlar's report, I also read the footnotes. So one of the footnotes on page 22, number 13, it says they were talking about the difficulty and the general concerns about Minute. And it says the state contracting statutes are outdated and that the state procurement processes are very time-consuming. And then further down it ends with, such issues may have affected the Minlar's project, but we did not investigate these more general issues for this review. So my question to you is, when you're thinking about the IT statutes and contracting statutes, what can we do as your partner to facilitate that work? It's just a general statement question. Something for you to think about when we're not over time. And then the other thing I would like to know, if you could share with us as a group, by email maybe later, or however you communicate, the percent of a corporate budget that is used on IT, what percentage in industry practice is spent on cybersecurity, so that we have some baseline. Like my colleague, I'm not an IT specialist, but I do appreciate the fact that from the time I've started work here, everything has worked for me, so I'm happy about that. And I do appreciate the idea that you just mentioned about the state having some autonomy in their code and autonomy in the products that we are producing, so that we are not beholden and held to account for higher fees by a vendor. I do appreciate that. And the other thing I'm thinking about is when we pass these bills, like let's say we have a great productive season this year. We have 1,000 bills that just we all agree on in this great era of bipartisanship. What does May 22nd look like for the IT department? Because as I'm reading through these bills, we are putting into statute all different kinds of pay structures and plans, and it is effective the day after enactment. So when I think about the IT department trying to keep up with what we have just put into statute, what do those days look like? And maybe that's a conversation for another day, but it's good for that.
Mr. Poyer, shortly, if you can.
Maybe I'll just go after that last one.
That's fine.
Right. As soon as the session ends, it's a crazy period. It's a crazy period for the folks that over on the MMB side, our IT folks that are supporting that. It's a crazy period for the Department of Revenue. It's a crazy period for the folks in DVS and the folks supporting Minlars, because it's always statutory changes that are associated with that. That said, that's something that happens every year, and it's something that everyone is prepared for to do. So actually, I appreciate that insight and the reflection that you had on that. Oh, my goodness, you know, we hit May 22nd, and all this stuff has got to be in place by July 1st. So, yes, it is a very busy period, but we've been able to meet that consistently over the years. I don't recall the other questions that were
It was about how we can help you by cleaning up the statutes that affect your procurement and maybe the IT policies.
Right.
That's for another day.
Okay.
And if you can, there are things that we can do in the future that would help us as a legislature to fix these things so that we don't have the conflicting requirements that then make it easier and make our systems work better. That would be great going forward. So,
yes,
and I think that we can get that back in email.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
And I think the other question she had that you can get back to us all in email would be the comparison of what percentage of cost that we have for cybersecurity compared to the private sector.
Based on the total budget spend.
Yeah.
That's how companies usually do it.
Right.
So okay. With that, I think we're 5 minutes over or 6 minutes over. So, members, it's been a good conversation, and thank you for coming and
thank you,
being honest and forthright with us. And with that, members, we're adjourned.